Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. The Forest Conference is over. The challenge to devise a plan just beginning. At stake, not only the Pacific Northwest, but a better understanding of all ecosystems. We'll have reports from the scene and analysis. Also this time, timber is not the only commodity of the forest. Salmon live there, too. And John Hoffman, editor of Discover Magazine, says the future belongs to those who work together around the world.
The thing is, it's not just a moral imperative we do this. Our own tenure on this planet is going to be nasty and short if we don't help these folks out.
These stories coming your way on The Environment Show. The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and this is Bruce Robertson. At the Forest Conference in Portland, Oregon, Rick Brown, wildlife biologist with the National Wildlife Federation, testified in response to a question from President Clinton as to whether the forests east of the Cascades should be included in the forest protection plans being considered for the region to the west along the Pacific coast.
The salmon, the steelhead that swim the Columbia River, pass beyond the Cascade crest. And they don't understand our distinctions between spotted owl forests and non-owl forests. Nor do the goshawk, the pileated woodpecker, the American marten, and other species that span both sides of the Cascades. To them, the Northwest forest landscape is one seamless tapestry of a forest ecosystem. And we must include, I believe, the east side forest in any resolution that we seek out of the processes that develop from today.
Brown was among the invited speakers at the conference discussing how to form a long-range plan for managing the timber resources and preserving the wildlife and plants of the region at the same time. All of the high-level discussion from the administration, the environmentalists, the scientists, and those representing the forest products industry assumed that we as humans understand enough about nature, about trees and wildlife, to control it, to manage it. And Brown said on his best days, he feels confident that we do understand the science of nature. But as he continued his late afternoon testimony before the president, Brown added,
"And then frankly, there are probably more days when I reflect, more modest, perhaps more honest days, and I think, I don't know anything about these forests at all. And on those days too, I believe that we must have fully protected permanent reserves as part of the solution to this system, to the issues in this region. Because more so for what we know about these forests, we need to protect the remaining old growth for what we don't know about it. Reserves are a hedge against our own monumental ignorance."
Peter Burley, president of the National Audubon Society, though not called to testify, was at the conference to observe. He joins us now from New York. Mr. Burley, what were the issues as you saw and heard them expressed there?
Well, I think that what the administration was attempting to do was to gather some input and then set the stage for the kind of hard bargaining and thinking that has got to go into making a solution. This was a summit which was characterized by process, but important process, because it was the first time that a number of issues really got aired before the national press and the public at large that are critical of this decision. One, for example, was the testimony from the folk who were concerned about fisheries, the salmon fisheries in particular, in which they made it clear that there are 60,000 jobs that are related to fisheries in the Northwest, which are at stake if all the rest of the forests go, since the ancient forest coming down silts up the streams and destroys habitat and stops the fish spawning. Once that became clear, then instead of the oversimplified equation of jobs versus owls, which is not the real question, but the way it's been cast, becomes a question of jobs versus jobs, because the 65,000 jobs in the fishery business that they received testimony about happen to be more people than those that work in the woods. So to the extent that the administration and the public at large gets an understanding of the broader implications of the forest issue, I think the process was a successful one.
This was a one-day affair, even one somewhat overshadowed as it came one day before the more maybe newsworthy summit with President Yeltsin the following day. How can we gauge the Forest Conference success? I mean, what really was accomplished there?
I think having the President of the United States and his top people visibly spending a day thinking about this represents a commitment of time and energy and intention which has never been made before. All of the various pieces of the government have been involved at various times, but you've never had the President sitting down saying, let me understand all of the pieces. And the fact that the President did that and then with his cabinet all in one place said, I want you guys to get together and start crafting a solution, should produce some results. As the President himself pointed out, there are so many agencies that have been involved in this to date, and frequently they've spent their time suing each other. This is not an acceptable way to make public policy or to save the forest. So I think the time and effort that was devoted to it was a prerequisite to achieving a result.
So you don't agree then that there were high hopes beforehand and then many disappointments afterward?
Well, I don't think anybody believed that this particular meeting was going to produce the solution. If they did, they were naive. I think the solution that we believe is critical is one which establishes reserves for the remaining ancient forest, establishes buffer zones around those reserves, and links them so that the ecological systems that they are part of stay intact, and also provides that this is based on science and in accordance with existing environmental law. That's going to take a lot of doing to achieve all of that, and you don't have that happen with a meeting like this, but I don't think you can also have it happen without a stage being set in which the President himself says, I want to wrap this thing up in a way that makes sense. Now, how they're going to come out still remains to be seen, but I think for the first time we've got a shot at a comprehensive solution which can't be done without the kind of prerequisites that are now occurring.
Peter Burley, President of the National Audubon Society, speaking to us from New York. Old-growth forests are 60 to 100 years old, distinct from ancient forests, which are hundreds of years old. The President heard testimony from the timber industry that the 1992 harvest of timber from federal lands, mainly from old-growth forests, was the lowest in two decades, and that as a result, thousands of jobs in the forests and the mills have been lost. It was said that court injunctions and federal laws are responsible. Yet the President also heard testimony that some of these losses are the result of economic downturns nationwide and globally, and from shipping raw, unprocessed logs to Japan. However, with only a small percentage of old-growth forest remaining of what once covered the region entirely, the real issue, said environmentalists and scientists, is not how much more forest should be open to cutting, but how much more should be protected. President Clinton asked Dan Tomaszewski, vice president of Sierra Pacific Industries, a timber-related firm, if he could agree to set aside more acreage, and if so, at what cost?
I think that it would be extremely difficult for a number of reasons. One, there is a feeling on the part of many that we already have significant old-growth reserves set aside through statute that will be there forever. Two, there is a feeling that if we were to set aside all of the remaining old growth, for instance, in the Pacific Northwest, that that would result in disaster for the timber industry. Now, having said that, we still stand willing to enter into discussions about how much old growth do we really need, where should it be distributed, and what would happen to it over time. But I think that's a difficult issue. That would be the death knell of the industry in the Pacific Northwest, if we set aside significant old-growth reserves on top of what's already been set aside. That's my view.
There was consensus among the scientists that it is simply not possible for humans to create an old-growth forest. It must occur naturally. And for this reason, they said, we cannot allow more old-growth to be cut. It simply takes too long to replace. The old-growth, then, is non-negotiable. Rick Brown wrapped up his testimony by characterizing the essential issue as seen from the ecologist's perspective.
I think the problems that the industry and the communities are facing is not the prospect of protecting the remaining 10% of the ancient forest. It is the speed and the extent to which we liquidated the first 90% is what we're really up against.
Compromise will come on the part of the timber industry to accept that old growth forests must stand, and to supply the mills, loggers must go into newer growth forests. There will be compromise from environmentalists, too, to allow this change, indeed, to help it happen. The president has asked his cabinet to take 60 days to review all the testimony and form a long-range plan for the region. That plan, chiefly and initially, will be of interest to the Pacific Northwest. But as all who participated in the conference agreed, the formulas for settling the disputes and the knowledge gained about that ecosystem will be useful in other areas with the same issues of economic growth and environmental protection. This is Bruce Robertson. Throughout the Pacific Northwest, rivers have long been known for their salmon and huge hydroelectric dams. But after a number of increasingly disastrous salmon migration seasons, many believe the two can no longer coexist. Proposals to protect the salmon by modifying the dams and surrounding land use are opposed by industrial, timber, and agricultural interests. They believe their livelihoods will be impacted. But conservationists say it's the only way the salmon will survive. More from Lee Garnett.
Redfish Lake in central Idaho once turned red with thousands of salmon carcasses every spawning season. But that was before hundreds of hydroelectric dams were built on the Snake and Columbia River Basin. Last season, only one sockeye salmon made it back to Redfish Lake. In 1991, the National Marine Fisheries Service listed the Snake River sockeye as an endangered species, and last year it put fall and spring-summer Chinook salmon on the threatened list. The listings made the Fisheries Service the final authority on salmon preservation. It put the Fisheries Service in a position to overrule the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Bonneville Power, the Bureau of Land Management, the Northwest Power Planning Council, and the U.S. Forest Service. Many lawsuits have been filed over salmon protection. David Bales is public lands director for the Pacific Rivers Council, which has challenged the Forest Service's timber management in salmon habitat.
Logging, road building, in some cases grazing, removal of large trees from the streamside area. In general, anything that affects the management of the vegetation along the salmon streams has a real potential for being destructive to their habitat.
The National Marine Fisheries Service recently blocked 11 major national timber sales in eastern Oregon because of potential harm to salmon spawning grounds. But environmental organizations are not the only interest that has gone to court over salmon. Direct Service Industries is a trade group composed of 11 manufacturers who depend on cheap hydroelectric power. Industry's Deputy Director, Steve Waddington.
Our lawsuit shows clear failings on the part of NIMS, National Marine Fisheries Service, to recognize and to modify harmful practices with regard to harvest, habitat management, and hatchery operations. In all three of these areas, in addition to the hydro system and dam passage, are the linchpins to the recovery of these stocks.
The Corps of Engineers maintains 8 huge dams on the Snake and Columbia Rivers. It has always operated those dams for navigation, power production, and flood control. Now, it must move endangered salmon to top priority. Salmon advocates, like Idaho Governor Cecil Andrus, are convinced the Corps must let the Snake River return to its natural flow during 2 months of the salmon migration season, a concept called drawdown. Andy Brunel is an assistant to Governor Andrus.
All of the studies that were conducted when these dams were being put in place show that as the river operates closer to the conditions in which it was when Lewis and Clark first canoed down the Snake River, that the fish survival rates is higher.
Idaho state officials are pushing for a drawdown this year. Last March, the Corps drew down the Snake River at two of its dams to test the dam's infrastructure at lower water levels. The Corps concluded its dams could support a natural river flow, but that it would need 17 years and $6 billion to make drawdowns work. Lieutenant Colonel Robert Volz explains the Corps' stance on drawdowns.
We see a lot of merit to the idea and think it's very worthy. However, we have not yet been able to figure out a way to safely pass fish around a drawn-down reservoir short of physically going in there and making permanent modifications. And for that reason, the Corps is not proposing any type of a drawdown test for 1993.
For more than 15 years, the Corps of Engineers has collected young salmon at Lower Granite Dam, loaded the fish on barges, and shipped them through seven large dams on the Snake and Columbia Rivers. Combined with hatchery programs, barging has been the government's prime answer to salmon protection. The Fisheries Service is expected to decide soon whether the barging program should continue. A Fisheries Service official says a denial of barging would be an indication that sweeping changes are imminent in river operations. The changes could include a seasonal return to a natural river during salmon migration. No matter which way the Fisheries Service rules, lawsuits are almost certain to follow. For High Plains News Service, I'm Lee Garnett.
The High Plains News Service is a production of the Western Organization of Resource Councils in Billings, Montana. Paul Hoffman is not waiting for the first 100 days to review the Clinton administration's environmental policy. Hoffman, editor-in-chief of Discover magazine, says confrontation was the key word in the Bush and Reagan administrations. Comparing the new administration with that of the two previous is easy, says Hoffman. The difference is one word.
We are seeing tremendous changes on the environmental front under the Clinton administration. And what those changes consist of, in a nutshell, is a collaboration between environmentalists and industry to make real, meaningful policy changes. I mean, the problem has been that you have, on the one hand, you have industry groups that will often do things that may be helpful and beneficial to their industries, but are short-sighted in terms of what they do to the total global environment or the environment in this country. And then you have environmentalists, which are trying for, you know, not building up in land and all sorts of rules and regulations, where some of them may be more important than others, and they haven't been very careful in prioritizing what we should do, and that's what the Clinton administration is trying to do. This conference that took place, the timber industry, I mean, it wouldn't have happened at all under the Bush administration because you couldn't get the groups to sit down in one room, for one thing, so it's a big accomplishment to begin with just to get all the parties talking, but that's the whole Clinton approach.
Hoffman cites as an example that Clinton picked Carol Browner to head the Environmental Protection Agency. Before coming to the EPA, Browner served in the same capacity in the state of Florida, during which time she had one particular instance to demonstrate her policy regarding wetlands protection. The incident involved the Disney Company, owner of Discover magazine, and plans to construct a parking lot over some wetlands in Orlando.
Now, the way wetlands policy works under the Bush administration is if you're a company and you fill in 5 acres of wetlands in Florida, you have to go make the equivalent of 5 acres of wetlands somewhere else in Florida. So this is what happens all the time. If you're putting in a shopping center, you fill in wetlands, and you buy land elsewhere, and you create a pond there. You dig it out. The problem with this is it just doesn't work. You end up with mud holes all over the place that construction companies create, and they don't have the diversity of life and the rich ecosystems and the kind of aquatic plant and animal life that you have in a natural pond. So in a way, it's a misguided policy because you're not getting back what you fill in. Now, what she made the Disney Company do in return for expanding their parking lots, a relatively small amount, she made them purchase a large nature preserve that isn't anywhere near their property, but one that had fallen into disarray that no one had been managing properly, and it's making the Walt Disney Company manage this as a nature preserve that there'll be no construction on, that will have trails that people can go on, and leaving all the land totally wild forever. So that's what she did, and you're going to see a lot of that, like in return for doing something which degrades environment, the Clinton administration will insist that you do something that everybody agrees is beneficial to it.
In the case of the Pacific Northwest, Hoffman says it may be too late to work on a system of exchanges.
Because the logging and deforestation has gone on to such an extent that it's going to be very hard to save that delicate ecosystem there. Not that we shouldn't try, but it's going to be hard. The Clinton approach in general is going to be to try to nip these problems in the bud a lot sooner before they, you know, become these very divisive issues that pit one group against another.
Hoffman says Clinton is right to insist that environmental protection and economic progress can and must work together. He cites the auto industry as an example of where and how this might work.
There's a big initiative to develop an electric car, you know, a car that will run on batteries and therefore be non-polluting. This creates a lot of jobs. I mean, it creates jobs in the technological R&D end. People have to come up with batteries that are longer lasting and batteries that are more easily rechargeable. I mean, it creates a whole slew of jobs in coming up with alternative energy solutions. Again, creates a whole lot of high technology jobs. And one of the things that the Clinton administration is looking at is, okay, we know that the military budget in our post-Cold War years is going to be cut quite a bit, that we don't need the same kind of military that we've had up to now. This is hurting defense contractors. So the question is, what can the government do to make it easier for some of these defense contractors, McDonnell Douglas, companies like that, to switch over maybe to helping us with things like electric cars and other environment? I mean, technology is going to be the answer to a lot of our environmental problems. So it's a question of retraining people and shifting jobs over, which isn't necessarily easy, but all these new forms of environmental technology, you know, are going to create jobs.
Given that our science, our technology, indeed our problems, are much more sophisticated today than they were just 10 years ago, Hoffman says the Clinton administration faces a major challenge, not only to fulfill its own promises and programs, but to do what really needs to be done to deliver us into the future with a healthy environment and a productive economy.
I think they'll be able to accomplish a lot, but it's a difficult problem, and it's difficult because the future of the Earth's environment doesn't just depend on what we do in the United States. We have third world countries, countries like China and India, that want to achieve the same standard of living as we have in the West. Now, what does that mean? They want cars. They want, electricity. They want fuels in their houses. These countries are racing towards moving, into the same industrialized age that we find ourselves living in. And they're going to repeat a lot of the mistakes that we've made. But the problem is those countries have much higher population than we do here. So if everybody in China has a car, if everybody is burning coal as a fuel, the world as a whole is going to be in a lot worse condition than what we've put it in. So what does that mean? Well, what it means is we have to help these countries develop other forms of energy. We have to lend our technological assistance and know-how, and it's going to cost us some money. But the thing is, it's not just a moral imperative we do this. Our own tenure on this planet is going to be nasty and short if we don't help these folks out, because the thing about the Earth's environment, I mean, whether it's the ozone hole or the greenhouse effect, I mean, it's one environment, it's one atmosphere that's being screwed up, and we have to help other peoples around the world.
Speaking to us from Los Angeles, Paul Hoffman, editor-in-chief of Discover Magazine and former senior editor of Scientific American. He is also author of some 10 books. We will be welcoming his observations from time to time in the weeks and months to come. For now, this is Bruce Robertson. Well, that's our report on The Environment Show this week. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. Audio coverage of the Forest Conference this week provided by C-SPAN, the cable satellite public affairs network. For a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 171. That's 1-800-767-1929. The Environment Show, program number 171. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.